This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Substance abuse was front and center of the news this week as top state officials called for review of regulations keeping treatment centers from adding beds. Many involved in this issue, like Laconia Police Chief Chris Adams, say treatment is severely lacking.
If you look at the number of people suffering from addiction versus the number of beds that are available in the state, it's way out of whack. So a big increase in that area would be great.
Presidential candidate Hillary Clinton focused on the issue as well, hosting a forum in Keene as part of a two-day swing through the state where she also talked about the high cost of college.
If you're going to hear people in this campaign talk to you about improving the economy, helping incomes rise, then ask them what they're going to do to make college affordable and begin to deal with the debt burden that is holding too many Americans back.
Meanwhile, on the Republican side, John Kasich's campaign is attracting more attention. At an event in Derry, Kasich addressed the question of whether he's too moderate to win the primary.
I don't know how the Republican Party ever got itself put in the trick bag by somehow saying that if we care about people who are down and out and we want to give them a chance to succeed, that somehow that's not conservative. I think it is conservative.
And speaking of elections, the next time you go to the polls, if you want to take a selfie with your ballot, go right ahead. A judge this week overturned the Granite State's law forbidding it.
The law was overbroad because it deprived voters of one of their most powerful means of letting the world know how they voted.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's roundup are Dan Barrick, Senior Editor for Politics and Policy here at NHPR. Dan, thanks for being here.
Hi, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, gentlemen, let's start with continued and rising attention on the opioid addiction crisis. Dan, lots of attention to increasing treatment availability. But as centers gear up to do this, some roadblocks are apparently in the way. What's going on?
Well, it came to light this week. It relates to the licensing requirements that treatment facilities need in order to maintain a certain amount of beds. There's federal requirements that an increasing number of centers, given the state's expanded Medicaid program, and more of these centers are receiving Medicaid funding to help cover the costs of caring for people seeking treatment, that they're subject to these new regulations that are limiting their ability to add beds. It's a real example of it's a real conflict that we have this increasing need, this demand for treatment centers, but a lot of these centers are saying these new regulations are impeding their ability to do so. So you saw Senator Kelly Ayotte calling for an easing of these regulations. Governor Hassan and the health commissioner put together a panel that's supposed to release some findings next month to see if there's a way to ease this. But this is really kind of where the rubber meets the road in the state's substance abuse crisis. How do you get people who are suffering from addiction? How do you get them into facilities where they can receive real treatment without overburdening the facilities with regulatory needs?
So, Dan, just to super clarify, please. So the regulations aren't necessarily new, but what's new is that Medicaid, under the Affordable Care Act, is going to cover more of these folks. And when you are treating Medicaid patients, you have to abide by extra rules from the federal government.
By federal regulations. Previously, before Medicaid expansion covered substance abuse expenses, you know, these facilities were subject just to basically receiving mostly state funds to pay for these costs. But the federal funds that come through Medicaid come with a different set of regulatory – a different regulatory framework. So trying to break that down to a lot – you know, to find a medium between, you know, we want to regulate facilities that are offering treatment to substance abuse addicts, but also, you know, being able to meet the demand that's out there in the community.
So, Dean, Senator Kelly Ayotte, an opponent of the Affordable mm-hmm. Care Act, yet came out strongly this week saying, hey, we need to get these folks treatment under expanded Medicaid. How do those two positions square with each other?
Sure. Some people might say it's a contradiction. Others would make a somewhat different argument. But, you know, I think from her perspective, you know, we have expanded Medicaid in the state. The money's there. You know, members of Congress always want to bring home whatever resources are available for their state. That's a time-honored tradition. At the same time, it's very hard to be kind of a player in national Republican Party politics if you don't oppose repealing Obamacare. You have to be in favor of repealing Obamacare. You know, her argument, and I've asked this question of other people in a similar situation, is, you know, okay, you know, this is a contradiction. And they say, well, it's not really a contradiction. There are other ways that this can be done aside from Obamacare. And also, you know, when you get down into the weeds, you find that members of Congress like certain aspects of Obamacare and they don't like other aspects. But this is a pretty typical ideological contradiction. You see it in both parties where, you know, when there's money available, you want to bring it home. At the same time, you've got these sort of larger dictates of your party's ideological position. So I think this kind of fits into that general set of issues.
Well, and speaking of money available, Dan, how is this drug treatment issue folded up into the broader issue of the state budget stalemate? Paige Sutherland had a great report on some of the impacts this week.
Well, it's one of a number of issues, but it's certainly near the top. So we're now, you know, into month two of the state essentially living without a fixed budget. We're operating under a temporary spending measure. But the addiction centers are one of the areas where, you know, our story tried to look at how is this stalemate in Concord rippling out to the community. And increased spending was one of the few areas where Republicans in the legislature and Democratic Governor Hassan agreed that there needed to be an increase. But because they couldn't reach a final budget proposal, that increase didn't come through. It's a real irony. Both parties agreed that we need more money for treatment, but those centers are not receiving that money. So, you know, facilities are not able to expand, add new beds because they don't have that extra money. Can't expand programs. It's from the funding side rather than the regulatory side, as we were talking earlier. But an example of how, you know, whether it's financial or political challenges are really limiting the ability of the treatment community to meet the needs of folks who are suffering from addiction.
Again, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Join us with your questions, comments, and thoughts on some of the top news stories of the week around the Granite State, 1-800-892-6477. Email again is exchange@nhpr.org. So, Dean, we've talked about this a lot on the Friday News Roundup, but what are your thoughts at this point? Here we are, mid-August, still no state budget in sight.
That's right. Well, you know, we thought, given what we heard from Republican leadership when the veto first occurred, they don't seem to have a lot of interest in working through this until the fall. They want the revenue estimates to have a sense of how much money is not carrying over. You know, it also, we've talked about how it does to some extent tie Governor Hassan's hands in terms of exploring a potential Senate race against Kelly Ayotte, because you know, at some point time is going to run short. And you know, we've also talked about how, you know, there's some agencies and some programs that were going to get increases. I think there was like a $1,000 bump up for per pupil spending for charter schools. Transportation department's not getting as much money, and this is a big construction season. Substance abuse increases for programs aren't there. So you know, we're in the 6 month continuing resolution at the same levels of spending we had in the previous budget. It's certainly problematic in a lot of ways. Doesn't seem like it's going to be resolved all that quickly.
Yeah. So Dan Page's piece again covered a wide array
of impacts that this lack of a state budget is having. Just give us a little bit more there. Dean hinted, but I'd like to hear from you too.
Yeah, so it's you know, I mean, everything from her story touched on the fact that Fish and Game can't buy fish food in bulk to
fish food.
You know, the hatcheries that they have around the state, they buy their food. You know, they try and take advantage of lower per pound expenses when they buy in bulk. They like to buy everything up front, but they've only got half of this year's budget, half a year's funding in place right now, so they can't buy a year's worth up front. So they're anticipating that they'll be paying a higher per prize pound. Two, you know, bigger road projects, like, you know, construction road projects on the Everett Turnpike, winter maintenance, things that require a lot of upfront outlay of funding. You know, if you just are in the State House, you don't necessarily hear a lot of this. As Dean said, there's not really a lot of very public, and I don't think even privately there's a lot of negotiating going on. And I wonder if how long, you know, Republicans have said they won't really do anything till September at the earliest. As figures come in, it may be more likely October. I don't know if you hear from schools and cities and towns that are having a hard time setting their tax rate because they don't know what their state aid programs will be. When you hear from, you know, people who are in need of substance abuse treatment where the beds aren't available, whether that kind of public pressure as opposed to the bully pulpit of the governor might lead to a break in this before the end of the year.
Go ahead. Did you want to finish up there, Dan? No. Yeah. So, Dean, one last question for you.
Sure.
Who does the public blame for some of these problems that Dan has outlined for us?
You know, hard to know at this point. You know, I guess it depends on your sort of where you're coming at this in terms of your particular ideology. You know, Governor Hassan's favorability ratings and approval have generally been pretty high. We haven't seen any huge hits to that yet. You know, she did have that compromise proposal she made recently in a press conference, and Republican leadership was not happy about that. They felt like it should have been done behind closed doors. Hard to say. You know, if this starts to drag on in the fall, I think it'll be a bigger concern. But right now, you know, people are sort of preoccupied with their summers. But, you know, they basically have this 6-month period to deal with it. And again, as we mentioned, there are all these other political ramifications that come out of a delayed agreement.
All right. Well, coming up, we're going to hit the campaign trail with several presidential candidates who were in the Granite State this week, including Ohio Governor John Kasich, neurosurgeon Ben Carson, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. We'll hear from those campaigns. We'll find out a lot more. Stay with us for more of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're going to spend some time now covering presidential candidates who were here this past week. And exchange listeners, let's hear from you, too. Did you see any presidential contenders roaming the state? Who would you like to get a chance to meet? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR's Dan Barrick is here, senior editor for politics and policy, along with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And joining us now, Paul Steinhauser, chief political correspondent for NH1 News. And Paul, thank you very much.
Great to join you guys. Thank you.
So who are you covering this week, Paul?
It was a very busy week. We had Hillary Clinton on Monday, Rand Paul and John Kasich Tuesday, Wednesday, and Ben Carson yesterday. So it's been pretty busy. And we got Donald Trump coming into the state tonight.
Right. Over on
Does
the seacoast.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been a busy year for sure. So who seems to be attracting the crowds, Paul, in your opinion?
You know who had a very good week here? John Kasich. Boy, what a difference a debate makes, maybe you can say, because I've been covering it since April when he's been up here very often. Doing okay, modest crowds, nothing huge. This week it all changed. He had a huge gathering in Derry, the VFW in Derry, probably 250, 300 people packed in there. A lot of people are saying it's because of his debate performance. He had a good debate performance back home. I think the other reason is those ads are pretty effective. His super PAC has been blasting ads here in New Hampshire. They're very positive. John Kasich had a great week. He also grabbed some big support with a guy called Tom Rath, one of the top GOP consultants in the state, the former attorney general.
So what do the ads say? Because I have not seen them, Paul.
They're basically biography ads. Most people in New Hampshire, I think all of you will agree, do not know who John Kasich is. So they explain who he is. And he has a folksy touch. He occasionally can be standoffish, but he's very folksy. He knows how to talk to the average person. He comes from humble beginnings, and the ads show those humble beginnings.
Well, and Dean, he's got a good resume, too. Got some definite experience in politics.
Yeah, he's many years in the U.S. House of Representatives, focused in particular on budgetary politics. Current governor of Ohio, won re-election pretty handily in a what's considered a swing state for sure. He's got a lot of experience. I talked to him a while back when he was still sort of figuring out whether or not he was going to run, and I think Paul's right. It's a combination of the debate performance. It's a combination of sort of the newness of him as a candidate combined with those biographical ads. New poll out. One of the, I sort of lost track of which poll, but at this point, he's right behind Jeb Bush. I think Bush is second at Trump's first, and Bush is second at like 13%, and Kasich is third at 12%, and that's bad news for Jeb Bush, because the argument has been that the two of them are kind of fighting for roughly the same group of voters. And the big question for Kasich, as Paul mentioned, is his temperament. He kind of alternates between being kind of sort of very folksy and good at retail politics, and then he's also sort of legendary for being prickly at times. So he has said he's working on that, but generally so far he's had a great reception here, and obviously the Tom Rath and endorsement certainly helped him. With signaling to other kind of Republican elites in the state.
So Dan Barrick, Dean mentioned that Jeb Bush and John Kasich kind of vying for the same group of voters. Is that the more sort of centrist Republican voters?
It is, and you heard Kasich addressing this directly this week in New Hampshire, talking about there's a number of policy issues that he's really on the outside of where the right wing of the party is right now. He, as governor of Ohio, he accepted expanded Medicaid through Obamacare. He supports the Common Core education standards, which are really anathema to a lot of conservatives. And he favors a path to legal status in terms of immigration. And he does not try and tiptoe around those positions. And he's, in fact, as we heard in the bite he played at the top, he's really trying to make an argument that this is a true conservative position, and that he's acknowledged that one of his challenges is going to be to really kind of re-engineer the mindset of the party. I think that those positions I don't think they will necessarily hurt him in New Hampshire. Those have Common Core has not really been a huge political issue here. We have expanded Medicaid. But I think it's definitely going to be one of the challenges if he's going to succeed beyond here.
In other primary states, Dan, where the electorate is more conservative than in New Hampshire. Let's hear a little piece of Governor Kasich addressing that issue.
I balance the federal budget. I balance the state budget. I've been a tax cutter all of my life and have the largest amount of tax cuts in America today of any sitting governor. Our credit is rock solid. When I left Washington, we were $5 trillion in the black. I've been a defense advocate and a defense reformer. I advocate school choice. We are aggressively working to trim the costs of higher education. What is there not to like?
Again, that's Ohio Governor John Kasich talking about his conservative bona fides. Gentlemen, let's talk about another candidate who was also in the state this week and also got a warm reception, Paul Steinhauser, and that's Ben Carson.
He did get a warm reception on Thursday. He had a jam-packed day, but he was talking about something he probably didn't want to talk about, and that is his past use of fetal tissue, his research on fetal tissue. Why is that important? Because Dr. Carson, who's a famed retired neurosurgeon, has been blasting Planned Parenthood like a lot of others have because of those videos that we've seen from the aborted fetuses. And people were saying, is this a contradiction? What you did 23 years ago, is that a contradiction with what you're doing now? I asked him that specifically yesterday when I interviewed him. He said no. What I did had nothing to do with killing babies. So he got distracted yesterday. But overall, Ben Carson is doing pretty much what he wants to do. He's on a slow, steady course, and he's grabbing support. He also, if you notice from the debate, he's not a flashy candidate at all. I asked him about that. I said, what do you think about what happened at the debate with Donald Trump and everybody else? He called it foolishness, and he said, I will never get into that mud pit.
Ben Carson, what kind of voters are coming to his events, Dean?
Yeah, well, he's doing quite well with social and religious conservatives. I think he's a bit of a blank slate at this point, and people can kind of project on him a variety of different views. He's doing well in Iowa. I think he's in second place in Iowa in some polls. You know, the caucus in Iowa is heavily dominated by evangelicals, I interviewed him last month, and our conversation was peppered with biblical references, and that appeals to religious voters for sure. So, New Hampshire's not necessarily the best fit for him. He's doing well in Iowa. But again, I think his main argument is his sort of biography and the fact that he's not a politician. The issue I had with him when we talked, you get into kind of policy and how Washington works. That's not really his thing. He's really focused more on kind of his sort of motivational abilities, his leadership abilities, separate from sort of politics and policy.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Dr. Carson. Here he is talking about poverty at a town hall meeting in Hooksett.
To me, care for the poor means creating a mechanism for the poor to climb the ladder of success so they don't remain poor. Somebody else's definition may be just to pat them on the head and make sure you take care of them and make sure they stay satisfied.
Again, that's retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, Republican presidential candidate campaigning in the Granite State this week. Join us as we catch up on some of the presidential news, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Gentlemen, here's an email from Lori who says, what happened to my favorite candidate, Martin O'Malley? Paul?
Martin O'Malley is still there, and he'll be back in the state of New Hampshire very soon. Listen, Martin O'Malley, you thought would be a progressive or a liberal's dream, right? He's got the looks. He's got the resume. He did a lot of progressive things when he was governor of Maryland, mayor of Baltimore. He just hasn't caught fire. Bernie Sanders has stolen that crowd. The Elizabeth Warren Democrats are right now with Bernie Sanders and not with Martin O'Malley. I've asked him about that specifically, and he said, I'm not worried about who's peaking in July or August. I want to be peaking in December or January when it counts.
Well, it's interesting because everybody says it's too early to really judge these polls, but then everybody says, did you see the poll? And Dan, Paul's right.
1%. He's a 1% guy.
But there was a lot of attention to that. Just the fact that such a heavyweight candidate like Hillary Clinton could be eclipsed in this poll by Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. And I mean, some of these polls, it's hard to know how to take them. You know, there's so much polling and there's so much competition for polling. And sometimes the methodology may be less than rigorous. But, I think Paul's right. I mean, in terms of, Martin O'Malley's seen this, but the folks who are not satisfied with Clinton, really, it seems that they found that Sanders is the candidate. I saw one interesting thing, though. I think it was that same Boston University poll that included Joe Biden, that if he were, as has been rumored, possibly get into the race, that he would draw the majority of his support from Sanders supporters.
Clinton.
No, so that there's that's where a lot of the folks who are looking for a Clinton alternative would, Biden would be just as good an option for some of them. So
real interesting. Okay, again, exchange listeners, if you want to jump in on this conversation, the number 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Lori, thank you for that email. And Dean Spiliotis, Hillary Clinton was in the state this week talking about two big issues, substance abuse. We heard from her earlier on that. And also talking about college affordability. What did Hillary Clinton say there?
Well, she rolled out a big college affordability plan. It's a $350 billion plan. And the idea is that if you as she said, and a number of Democratic candidates have said this, I think including both O'Malley and Sanders, that if you go to a public college or university, I think Sanders wants it to be free, but a minimum, Hillary Clinton said you shouldn't have to take out loans. So it's all about kind of reducing student debt. There are a couple issues with her plan in terms of actually selling it to Congress. It has some tax increases, capping tax loopholes for wealthy individuals, or capping itemized deductions for wealthy individuals. It also sort of the internal logic says you need to incentivize schools to control costs, which is challenging. And you also need to incentivize states to give more money. So, you know, you think about how, you know, we're likely to have a Republican Congress, even if she wins the presidency in the next Congress. So how do you sell a tax increase like that to Congress? I'm not so sure. So, I you know, she's certainly part of the conversation. This is a big part of the conversation among Democrats. Everybody's talking about different ways to deal with the cost of college and student debt. But, you know, you really have to look at the sort of the saleability of these things to what will likely be a Republican Congress. I think it'll be a challenge, but nonetheless, she's jumped into the conversation with this big proposal. And she also was talking about, you know, the drug crisis as well, substance abuse this week.
Yeah, talking about it in a forum in Keene. Yep. Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I covered her at Exeter High School. That was her first big event back on Monday. That's where she laid out the College Affordability Act. College affordability plan. But what really struck me is she came back later after the event was over. She came back and talked to those of us in the press corps. And some of the things she said, she was asked repeatedly about Donald Trump and, of course, the whole Donald Trump, Megyn Kelly back and forth. She was critical, but not that critical. And Andrea Mitchell really came back at her hard and said, wait a minute. What he said about, you know, Megyn Kelly and her menstrual cycle and all that. And then Hillary Clinton finally got emotional. You don't see this very often. And she said, it was offensive. It was outrageous. And I stand by that. Even more interesting, she tried to lump the rest of the field with Donald Trump. And she specifically went after Marco Rubio, Senator Rubio of Florida, for his comments at the debate saying no exceptions at all for rape.
For
abortion,
sure.
Not for rape or incest. And she said that is even more damaging, that is even more dangerous than what Donald Trump has said. So she got a little emotional when really pushed.
Well, and I had seen what you just talked about, Paul, that Hillary Clinton is trying to sort of put them all in the same group.
Exactly.
And tar them all with the same Trump brush. So for those who are turned off by Trump, she's trying to turn people off to the whole field. I don't know, does that work? I mean— There's some differences there.
But it's an extension of this sort of political argument about the war against women. Democrats used it very, very effectively in 2012 against Mitt Romney, that Republicans in general from an ideological perspective are on the wrong side of a number of issues, not just choice, but just sort of, you know, all kinds of family planning, birth control, all that sort of stuff. So I think this is their attempt to kind of continue to use that issue.
Again, the number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. A couple Facebook comments on this Hillary Clinton college plan. Sean says it's Bernie Sanders' plan. She's just hijacking it. Kathy says, I don't care who implements this idea. We deserve for our future to have a reprioritization of where our tax dollars go. And Kayla says her plan does nothing to help those who are currently saddled with student loan debt. Thank you for those Facebook comments. You can give us your comments, too, on Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Just a couple more presidential questions for all of you. And Dan Barrick, another candidate possibly jumping in this week, Lawrence Lessig, the Harvard professor and campaign finance reform champion, this week announced his intention to run. What's this about, Dan?
Well, Lawrence Lessig is well known in that in those policy circles around reforming. Basically, I mean, he paints a much broader stroke than that, really reforming the entire democratic process. He was involved last cycle, put together an organization that tried to actually, you know, raise money. It was sort of an ironic super PAC to try and raise money to help get candidates to discuss this. He's been an informal advisor to the Sanders campaign on this issue, but he came out this week essentially saying he doesn't feel any of the candidates are really going far enough to really address what he thinks is the fundamental issue plaguing our democracy right now, which is the influence of money on elections. So he's indicated he's a very interesting and unusual proposal that he would run if elected. He would seek to that it would essentially be a national mandate on this issue that America felt that campaign finance reform was the most important issue. He would pass a slate of platforms and then resign. And the elected vice president would then assume office. Not the typical stump speech. But
hopefully he has a good vice presidential candidate.
Right, right. But it's interesting. And, you know, I guess if anything else we've learned this cycle, there's always room for more on the campaign trail. So,
well, Paul, who else is coming to the state this weekend and next week?
Guess who's coming this weekend? A guy we haven't seen much of. He says he's running for president. I don't really believe him until he's up here a lot. That's Jim Webb, the former senator of Virginia. We haven't seen him in a while. He announced for president, well, it was like a month ago, and now he's making his first trip. Most people, they announce, and they're up here within a day or two.
Sure.
I like Jim Webb a lot. He's an interesting guy. I've interviewed him a few times, but his campaign needs to pick it up. They're saying, listen, we're going to wait till September, and then we're really going to pick up steam. He needs to get up here more often. So he'll be up here this weekend. George Pataki, the former New York governor, is up here today and tomorrow. Next week, there's a big education summit at Londonderry High School on Wednesday. You're going to see a bunch of the Republican presidential candidates up here for that, and then they'll be campaigning throughout the week.
Oh, that'll be interesting. Okay, I hadn't heard about that. So just remind us real quickly, Paul, Jim Webb, Democratic side. We talked about him when he jumped in, but just give us a quick sketch there.
Fascinating guy. He actually served in the Reagan administration as a Navy secretary, as former Marine. But yes, he won election to the U.S. Senate as a Democrat in 2006. His election was crucial to help the Democrats win back the chamber. He only served one term, decided not to run for re-election in 2012. And here he is now running for president for the Democratic nomination. But again, we need to see more of you, Jim. Come up here. Come on up.
As Paul said, he's an interesting fellow. Kind of marches to his own drummer. You know, he is a decorated Marine from Vietnam. He was Reagan's Secretary of the Navy, then resigned pretty shortly thereafter in kind of protest of the amount of money being spent. And then, you know, he ran for Senate. People thought he was set up to maybe a second time, but he decided he wanted to run again. He's also an accomplished novelist.
Novelist?
Yeah, he's written a number of very, very popular novels. And so he's just a very interesting character, but no one can quite figure out, you know, sort of why he's doing this or kind of what his approach is. But we'll see. He is coming back, I think, for at least one day of events this weekend.
Okay, and super quick, Paul, I'm going to throw this to you. Why are some Democrats upset with the party's national debate planning?
Because there's only six debates and New Hampshire only gets one. And that one debate will not be just before the primary in February. It'll be in December, just before Christmas. So a lot of Democrats, especially here in the Grand Estate, want to see more. You know, the Republicans are only doing one debate as well, but at least theirs is right before the primary. The Democratic debate is going to be, I think, the 16th or 17th of December.
And they have a bunch. Republicans have a bunch more.
They have a bunch
coming.
More. They got a bunch more. They got a bunch more candidates, though.
Paul, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here. That's Paul Steinhauser of NH1 News. Coming up, we'll talk about Carol Shea Porter possibly jumping back in to regain that first district seat that she lost last year. And we'll find out more about the politics of Planned Parenthood. So stay with us for that. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us as we cover some of the top stories of the week around the Granite State, from presidential candidates to the politics of Planned Parenthood. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Dan Barrick is here. He's senior editor for politics and policy for us here at NHPR, along with Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, here's an email that just came in from Peg in Concord. I'm disappointed that the media in general, and even your guests, continue to write off Bernie Sanders in spite of the support he is getting from the people. Peg says he doesn't have a PAC to spend millions of dollars on ads in the national media, but she says we're hoping he can overcome the money and prove our democracy is not for sale. Peg, thanks for the email. Dean, what do you think?
No, that's a very important comment. A couple reactions. You know, Bernie certainly is drawing tremendous crowds around the country. In fact, the GOP has been up to a little bit of mischief, putting together a clip package of all the huge crowds he's drawing to kind of show it to the Clinton campaign. You know, there are a couple issues with him. One is you look at kind of the data on him. He has very deep support among progressives, a very specific type of progressive, sort of educated, fairly affluent, typically white. And so he's drawing big crowds in places like Seattle and Portland, and I'm assuming he could do it in Cambridge and kind of the coast. So the rap against him is that he has not shown kind of a broader ability. You know, the Democratic Party has a variety of different constituencies, and he has to show kind of a broader appeal to those. The second thing is you look at the data, and majorities of Democrats still believe, even though they like Bernie, they believe that Hillary Clinton will be the nominee. So until he can change that and people start sort of really in their minds thinking of him as a potential nominee, he'll get big crowds, he'll have deep support. But the support is still too narrow, and in the end, Democrats think that Clinton is likely to be the nominee. So it's a challenge to reverse that psychology. But there's no denying that he's having a big influence. It's interesting. The Clinton campaign has sort of largely ignored him, and we're all wondering if that's going to change at some point.
Interesting. Well, Peg, thanks for the email. Dan, you want to follow up?
Yeah, I mean, all that may be true, but I do think in New Hampshire, nobody who's paying attention to the race here would write off Bernie Sanders. And it's true he doesn't have a PAC. He may not have the kind of dollars, especially outside of his own campaign fundraising, to compete dollar for dollar with the Hillary Clinton. But, you know, we did a story a couple weeks ago looking at just his grassroots organization, and this is a real campaign. They have a very sophisticated network in New Hampshire, town by town. They are competing very seriously and in a very organized way to win this primary.
Again, the number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Peg, thank you again for that one. You know, gentlemen, another story that made news this week, the controversy over Planned Parenthood funding continuing nationally and here in New Hampshire. With us now for more on that story is Dave Solomon with the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Hey, Dave, thank you for your time.
Hi, Laura.
So you had a story this week, Dave, about the issue of Planned Parenthood's federal funding and how this issue may be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. This is a little confusing, Dave. Who's bringing this case and why?
Well, the Supreme Court case was filed back in 2011 when the executive council for the state first voted with the Republican majority at the time to refuse a contract to fund Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. At the time, it was even more significant than the vote last week, because in 2011 and in prior years, the funding for Planned Parenthood was entirely channeled through the state Department of Health and Human Services, and that contract had to be approved by the Executive Council, even though 75 or 80% of it or more was federal funds. So the vote by the council in 2011 really did defund Planned Parenthood. And almost immediately, the federal government basically said that through the federal Department of Health and Human Services, well, we're going to take our money and contract directly with Planned Parenthood. And it happened so quickly that the three members, Republican members of the executive council, protested, and New Hampshire Right to Life shortly thereafter, with the help of New Hampshire and national attorneys, did file the lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act to learn how it happened that the federal government acted so quickly to fund Planned Parenthood. They arguing there couldn't have been enough time for them to submit an application, for the government to issue a request for proposals, and so forth. And so that's been working its way through the courts for 4 years, and now is on its way to the Supreme Court.
Wow. Okay. So New Hampshire Right to Life said, look, you know, we took this vote here at the state level. Federal government, you just can't jump in and do this, basically.
Well, they're not saying you can't, but they're saying we'd like to see how you did it. We'd like to see the emails, the interagency correspondence. We'd like to see the full application from Planned Parenthood that enabled the federal government to contract with them directly in this fashion. And over the years, as it's worked its way up through the court system, the government, Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level has released 2,500 pages worth of documents, some of which New Hampshire Right to Life has found quite revealing, but not the smoking gun they're looking for that says this was an arbitrary decision that was done without proper procedure.
So, Dave, has it been decided yet whether the U.S. Supreme Court will take up this case or not? I know they have a whole process where they decide yes or no.
Yeah, they won't decide until the first Monday in October when they reconvene and announce what cases they intend to hear in their next session. But the case, at this point, the last action was at the U.S. Court of District Court. At that level, Department of Health and Human Services prevailed. The judge there ruled what they've released is appropriate. What they're holding back, they're allowed to, because it's trade secrets, proprietary information that would be of benefit to Planned Parenthood competitors and arguments like that.
Okay. Well, Dave, last question for you, please. How does what you just described, this possible U.S. Supreme Court case, fit in with the debate over state funding for Planned Parenthood that we heard just recently?
Well, it doesn't have a lot to do with the debate going on in the state. That's going to be a huge political issue in both the gubernatorial and senatorial campaign. And the question of whether the federal government acted appropriately or politically in funding them back in 2011, everybody on each side of that debate has pretty much come to their own conclusions on that score, and it's just a matter of verification.
Okay, Dave, thank you very much for helping us out with this.
All right, thank you.
That's Dave Solomon of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. You're listening to the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, a couple other stories that we do need to follow up on. Dan Barrick, this week the Manchester School Board voted no confidence in Mayor Ted Gatsis. How come?
Well, it's sort of a bit of a long story, but it centers on the contract that the city has with its teachers union. Teachers there have been without a contract for a couple of years, no pay raises. There was a negotiated contract reached that was passed by the school board. The mayor decided in his capacity as mayor to veto that, to essentially put trash that contract. Understandably, that outraged a lot of teachers. They came to a school board meeting last week to voice their displeasure, and the school board itself made a motion to censure the mayor, to take a no confidence vote.
And not just the teachers, but the school board.
But the actual school board by an overwhelming majority. So this is an important issue, obviously, for the city schools and its teachers. But I think what's also interesting, it's the mayor's up for reelection this year.
They have off-year elections
odd years. Ted Gatsis is obviously a well-known figure in Manchester politics. He's been in office now for several years, in various offices for several years. But there's a real – I think this issue is kind of a stand-in for the opposition, for the shape that the campaign will play. The mayor has made education one of his top priorities. He's very interested in schools. He spends a lot of time in schools. He's very interested in what's going on. But there's a sense, I think, among his opponents that this contract veto is emblematic of both his style, sort of heavy-handed, and his putting the larger school system at risk over, that's really harming the quality of education in the schools.
Well, another political story from the 1st Congressional District, which includes Manchester. And Dean, I'll turn to you on this. A familiar name, Carol Shea Porter, decided she might get back in the running for that 1st District seat that she keeps winning and losing.
Yeah, she filed some paperwork this week suggesting that is, in fact, her intention to do so. Just a little bit of history for people. You know, Carol Shea Porter first won the seat in 2006. She defeated incumbent Jeb Bradley. This was the so-called Democratic tsunami. Democrats took control of Congress. It was a response to the Iraq War and some problems with the economy under the Bush administration. She then lost to Frank Ginta in 2010, won it back in 2012 with Obama's reelection, and then lost it again in 2014 when Republicans made big gains to Frank Ginta. And then now we have this sort of FEC issue with Ginta that goes back to the 2010 win. So she's been around for almost 10 years now. And, you know, she filed so that in her, you know, so she can either run if for some reason Ginta were to resign, she could run in a special election. I don't think that's going to happen. We're only a little over a year away now. Or she can run, excuse me, in 2016. And it's interesting. I've talked to a lot of Democrats in the last few days, and the reactions break down 50-50. Sort of half the group says, you know, Carol Shea Porter, again, you know, isn't there sort of, you know, a bench, a Democratic bench? And there is a Sean O'Connor is a Bedford entrepreneur who's going to run. But, you know, you would think after 10 years there'd be sort of a vibrant Democratic primary. So half of them say, oh, you know, not again. And the other half says, well, no, wait a minute. You know, Carol Shea Porter has been a very strong progressive. They like her values. They like her ideology. They like what she's done during her time in Congress. So she has a sort of a group of strong, tenacious supporters that will make her competitive. But she is definitely getting back into the mix.
Well, and Carol Shea Porter, again, isn't saying definitively she's going to run, right, Dean? She's got sort of all the
it gives her an
framework
op- it gives
place.
her Right. You got to get it in place so you can start raising money. I mean, I would be surprised if she didn't, but, you know, she hasn't definitively said so at this point.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners, gentlemen. And Emma's joining us from Manchester. Hi, Emma. You're on the Friday News Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. I just wanted to call in and say one of the people on the show commented that the mayor has been focused on education for his 6 years in office. I would say that that's not quite true, because most of his focus on education has been making education a political issue and making things that should be standard and you know, agreed on bipartisanly. They have been making them, like the teacher's contract, an issue of politics and not an issue of what the city needs and what the city's students need. So I would argue that in many ways he hasn't been helping education. He's been standing in the way of progress in our city schools.
Okay. So, Emma, don't sound like a Gatsis supporter in the coming election this fall.
No, definitely not. I'm a recent graduate of Manchester schools, and I've been very frustrated for a long time.
All right. Good to hear from you, Emma. Thank you for joining us. I did want to ask you gentlemen about a couple other stories, and this is a fun one, Dan Barrick, that I'll turn to you. At the State House, there's an effort, a volunteer effort, to honor a New Hampshire suffragist with a portrait. Now, who is this? This is a great story.
Right. It is a great story. Her name's Marilla Ricker. She was an attorney from Dover. Who spent basically her entire adult life trying to cast a ballot. Every day, I believe, going back to the 1870s, every year she'd go down to the local polling place, try and vote, and she'd either be turned away because she was a woman, or she'd cast the ballot and that ballot would be destroyed. She did this every year for 50 years, and the sad part, the tragic part of the story is that she died just weeks after women won the right to vote in America, but it's unclear whether or not she was sick in her final days, whether she was well enough to actually cast a vote. So there's an effort by several groups to try and honor her legacy and her tenacity to have a portrait painted that will hang in the State House. The legislature passed legislation allowing that to happen, but they did not fund such a portrait. So this would be to actually raise the money to actually have it painted, so that it could be displayed and add her story to all the other stories in the State House.
Well, and this is an effort, as you said, by some volunteer groups. The League of New Hampshire Women Voters and the New Hampshire Women's Bar Association are raising money to commission the portrait. Let's hear a little bit from co-president of the League of Women Voters, Liz Tentarelli. This is on the efforts to put up a State House portrait of New Hampshire suffragette Marilla Ricker.
We like to imagine when all these little fourth grade groups go to the State House to study the workings of our state government and they see portraits, that they will see Marilla's portrait up there and the little girls will say, "What did that lady do?" And we hope one of their teachers will read the plaque to them and understand just what a groundbreaker Marilla Ricker was.
Again, that is Liz Tentarelli. She's with the League of New Hampshire Women Voters talking about Marilla Ricker, getting that portrait up there. Let's go back to our listeners, gentlemen. And Sue is calling from Lee. Hi, Sue. You're on the Friday News Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi. This is with respect to your comments on Carol Shea Porter possibly running. And your commenter didn't mention that the Democratic Party registration for District 1 is only 26%. So it's really rather remarkable that she ever won at all. She clearly was pulling in a lot of independent votes every time she won. And you also didn't mention Frank Inta's lies, which, you know, just came out with the FEC ruling. 5 years of lies about not actually
the campaign finance issue.
Yeah. Finance.
And Sue, in the interest of time, I'm going to let you go, and I apologize. But Dean, she's right in that the first district, the first congressional district, does skew a little bit more Republican.
Yeah, that's right. It traditionally does. It does lean more Republican than the second congressional district. You know, the issue with these two-year House seats is that during presidential years, you have sort of a much bigger Democratic turnout than you do in these midterms when you get sort of better Republican turnout. So, I mean, that has sort of helped Frank Inta and hurt Carol Shea Porter. And then the presidential years have certainly helped her get reelected. So, yeah, that certainly shows kind of, you know, she has a sort of tenacious group of supporters. During the presidential year, she does draw a lot of independents. I think that will help her as well. I mentioned the Frank Ginter from 2010. People can characterize it however they would like.
But the campaign finance issues.
Yes,
it's
certainly going to be a cloud hanging over him. Absolutely.
All right. Well, gentlemen, next week on The Exchange, boy, we've got a lot planned. One father's story of his son's struggle with mental illness and the criminal justice system. That's going to be a compelling show next week for us. How about you, Dan Barrick? What stories are you going to be watching next week?
Well, one thing I'll be keeping an eye on among the presidential field, Republican Carly Fiorina will be back in the state for the first time in several weeks. Like John Kasich, I think she is the beneficiary of a very strong debate performance, a lot of new attention on her, and just be interested to see. She's going to be here for a long stretch. What kind of crowds and attention and notice she's getting out there from New Hampshire voters.
All right. Well, definitely keep an eye on that. How about you, Dean?
Well, Donald Trump's going to be back. He is leading in New Hampshire in the polls. I'm really interested to see Jim Webb. We mentioned the former Democratic senator. He'll be here for the first time in a long time. And I just wanted to mention that I interviewed Rand Paul a few days ago, and you can find a link to my interview with Rand Paul on my website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. We gave him a little bit of a break from the horse race, and we focused more on foreign and domestic policy.
All right. Got to cut you off there, Dean.
Sure.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks.